The detention practices, they're all separate, and I think it's within our best interest to separate those. And black sites are just encumbered with that.
One last one on terror-related issues. This administration has made Iran a priority in declaring that it's engaged in terror-related activity. On Monday, on Tuesday, just before coming out here, the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, who had negotiated the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, saw a number of us in New York and made two arguments. The first is that he believes at this point the administration's determined effort to try to convince American allies and partners, including President Trump's comments at the G20, were in violation of the JCPOA, which says that Iran must be able to enjoy the full benefits of reintegration in the Western economies, and that the United States and its partners will do nothing to try to impair that. And he basically charged that you're trying to reimpose nuclear sanctions by renaming them as terrorism related or something else. The second argument he made was that given American activities in Syria and elsewhere, we were in a bad position to be lecturing the Iranians about how they should operate in their own neighborhood. So I just wanted to see if you wanted to talk about that for a little while.
So let's see, there's two questions there. The yep. First is the Iranians accuse us of bad activity.
The Iranians accuse you of violating the terms of the JCPOA.
Okay. So let me answer it this way. The JCPOA has consumed a lot of oxygen in this debate for good reason. Our president's been very clear that he believes it's a bad deal. I believe they have every reason to comply with the letter of a bad deal. It's a bad deal. So, of course, it's in favor of them, and it's in their interest to comply with something that doesn't impose pain on them in a way that we would have preferred to impose pain on them had we been in office. So for them to then come back and accuse us of bad action and bad activity, it's a kind of a probably a name-calling exercise, David, and I'll address it in a little bit of a different
way. You may view it as a bad deal, and whether it was good or bad, or as the president said to me in an interview last year when he was a candidate, he could have negotiated a much better one. The problem you're not dealing with Iran right now is a race toward nuclear weapons. And of all of the complications you have, you don't have the additional complication right now of
that. Well, I hope you're right. You seem self-confident. But I'm not.
Do you have any evidence that they are, in fact, pursuing nuclear weapons at this point?
I have every hope that they're not, and no reason to believe that the deal did or did not change their aspirations. And so what I'd like to do is point out that they are not only bad actors, but they are bad actors outside the four corners of this arrangement. So we're talking about the arrangement and their compliance with the spirit of it, whether they did or didn't pay their rent on time, and whether they mitigated that later by paying it late, right? Whether they had heavy water or didn't. Now, what I'm trying to indicate here is the Iranian pattern of behavior is more troubling than just the four corners of this document. They've continued to take hostages, and they need to release or return Bob Levinson. They've continued to take hostages as a tool and a tactic. They've continued to mistreat people in their region with regional aggression, right? They've continued to be a state sponsor of terrorism. They're unsettling conditions in Yemen and the Saudi Arabian southern border region. This is behavior that's outside the four corners. It's within my scope and my lane of responsibility. They're a state sponsor of terrorism. There are things that concern me. And so I'd like us to pursue Iranian sanctions and start building a bigger case and a broader case for our concerns with Iranian behavior and I don't want to get away from, it's fair reporting, but expand a little bit the conversation.
And what kind of sanctions do you have in mind?
Well, right now we're making a case for additional financial sanctions. But I think that those sanctions can be pretty much as broad and consistent with their bad behavior as we can do within our legal system.
And once again go after their ability to export oil. That was, in the end, what we learned during the run-up to the accord was that the only thing that really gets their attention is their oil capability. Do you envision the Trump administration seeking sanctions that would restrict their ability to export oil?
Yeah, I don't want to issue the threat. I'll let the president decide that for himself.
Okay. Syria, which we touched on very briefly in the course of the Iran conversation. So the Washington Post, the Times, others all reporting today that the president made a decision a number of weeks ago to wind down
the program to help support the rebels in Syria, in part because it wasn't being very successful, and in part because the rationale for it had somewhat eroded. You've no longer made the removal of Assad a priority, and because of the negotiations you have underway with Russia on deconfliction zones, you no longer are trying to get the Syrians to come to the negotiating table the way Secretary Kerry attempted for the past year and last year and a half of the administration. So to the degree that you can talk about that decision-making and the goals, tell us where we stand there.
I smile because it's your second classified program you'll ask me about.
Probably not the last.
And the second time, I'll say I long for the day that we stop reporting those. And believe that we could have done it without and made the same case. Uh-huh. That said, without addressing that program or its existence or whether we have a program to even discuss, David, I'd like to say that you've focused the problem a little bit better than we talked about. And that is the notion of whether we prioritize Assad's removal or not, right? And I think there's probably even some question as to whether the last year of the Obama administration had seen agreement among seniors. Maybe if your reporting is to be believed, there was some disagreement at that point and at that time between the Secretary of State and the President as we concluded that administration.
More than a little.
And so I'd say it's pretty fair for us to take a relook at that. And what clearly this President has done is attain some ceasefire that's durable through some cooperation with the Russians, despite all the domestic political brouhaha. I think he's shown some courageous leadership there. I think he's demonstrated the desire, at least, to have safe havens so that we don't have a refugee and a migration problem that plagues Europe and eventually the United States in a way that we can't maintain security control of. And I think that at some point there's a large humanitarian effort there that needs to be recognized. And so we'll see if the safe haven holds, we'll see if the ceasefire holds. But I don't think it's important for us to say Assad must go first. But I think it's absolutely imperative for me to correct the record and suggest that the United States still would like to see Assad go at some point. And I think we've made that clear to our partners and to the Russians and to the regime itself that that would be our desired outcome. But we need a political outcome in Syria. We don't need a militarily imposed outcome with no political strategy to fill in that void when we're gone. And we need to figure out how we're going to rebuild Syria after that. And I think it's pretty clear to the world that Assad still in control is not going to be the best future case outcome for a peaceable, politically resolved Syria. And so whether it comes first or second or soon thereafter, it would be a nice outcome.
Do you believe that to rebuild Syria, you must or should keep Syria within its current boundaries? Do you believe that ultimately Syria is going to end up getting broken up?
Oh, I certainly hope not, but I'll defer to Rex on that. So we have a Secretary of State who's now managing what you know to be one of the most difficult issues between the Turks and the Iranians and the Jordanians and the Israelis. All in that area, the neighborhood of the Middle East. I don't think that there's a border conversation that would be productive right now, but we certainly have partners that are pursuing what we need them to pursue to defeat ISIS first and to maintain some stability and control in safe zones second and to maintain a ceasefire in the south third. Now, you asked about Iran. I'd certainly hope that they don't continue their regional aspirations and pursue their aggressive activities through this so-called land bridge or crescent. That would be a further destabilizing effort that we can't tolerate.
Let's turn to some cyber issues, because it's the other big part of another big part of your portfolio. So let me start with the most basic question. Director Coates, who we saw in the audience here, Director Pompeo, who we'll hear from this afternoon, have all said to Congress and others that after reviewing the intelligence, they are persuaded that there was a comprehensive program by the Russians to try to go affect the outcome of last year's election. The revelations on that started just a little over a year ago when we learned about the DNC hack through the CrowdStrike revelations. So first, you've now had a chance to review all of this. Do you believe there was a comprehensive Russian program? And do you believe the Russians are going to come back here and elsewhere in the world to try to influence future elections?
Yeah, so there's a pretty clear and easy answer to this, and that's yes.
Like I said, you're short. direct? Okay.
So, okay, now let's talk about what's really relevant here. The misunderstandings that surround that, yes. What we have is a foreign nation state engaging in a behavior on a inherently unsafe medium, the internet, to try to collect, steal, and then release embarrassing information, among other things, from the DNC that we saw that ranged from a risotto recipe to some internal memos of some import at a political committee. Now, we all then have to debate whether you were, any one of you, persuaded by any of that rhetoric and those releases and those unacceptable efforts and behaviors by a foreign nation state when you came to the polling place. But it's always a worthwhile practice for me to remind everyone, especially because there are viewers that aren't as edified as this group that are watching elsewhere, that there was no evidence. And so those same people that gave you that commentary to lead into that question, and to include Mr. Brennan, who's here, have also, and Mr. Clapper, who will be here, said that there was no evidence of hacking into the ballot boxes. So we don't have an election that was tampered with at the ballot box. What we have is a foreign nation state getting caught, and among others, acting badly on the internet and attacking what we will, what I'll call the .com. Mm-hmm. And then I'm not trivializing this, but there's the .gov, if you will, and that's the spy versus spy game that we always talk about.
You are listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum titled No Room for Error, Advising the President on Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. This is Aspen Public Radio. It is our summer pledge drive. We can only bring you live broadcasts like this one with your financial support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
In that regard, the government has a big responsibility, but I think we have an even bigger one to increase our defenses and do it more quickly.
So, Tom, you and I have spent a lot of time talking about cyber deterrence.
Let me come back to
sure.
that. But if you pivot to deterrence, it's important to know that increased defense is one half of deterrence. And the other half is what I suspect you're about to ask me about.
Well, we'll get to increased offense in just a minute. Okay. But on the deterrent side here, given the magnitude of the Russian effort and all that we've heard about it, do you believe when we look back at this incident 5 years, 10 years from now, we will determine that the Russians paid a big enough price for what they did in order to bring about some level of deterrence from their future activity?
So right now, there's no bad cyber actor. Other nation states have acted poorly. The last administration rightly called out the Chinese, the Iranians, the North Koreans, the Russians. There are a number, and they tend to not be countries that are like-minded with our worldview. And they are right now not paying enough. They're not paying anything. It's a very cheap exercise for them and a very high reward, and so no. Now, if you're asking me whether in every individual's mind that they're going to get a commensurate punishment and comeuppance, that's going to be hard to answer. There's probably 340 million opinions on that in this country. But right now, I would say that there's not one single price that one single bad actor on the internet is paying that's high enough, both punitive or preventative. And we have an incumbent responsibility to either change that equation or to announce this a dead technology that we can no longer rely upon. I am not ready to do that. I'm ready to put some policy changes in place that are going to increase the cost to the bad actor, and then unify the like-minded so that we can throw the people that are not on that page out of the internet if necessary.
So put that in the context of, had that new policy been in effect when the Russians were coming after the State Department unclassified emails, the White House unclassified emails, the JCS, and then the activity during the election. In your mind, understanding that your cyber deterrence report is not due until August, if I remember, what kind of activity, what kind of responses do you think would have been appropriate for the United States to enact across the range of those activities, the three attacks I mentioned and then the election?
Well, let's review what we did. So the last administration punished them, sanctioned them, issued a national security emergency in order to allow those authorities to predate and presage those actions. This president, Trump, continued that national emergency and continued those sanctions. Both presidents
by the sanctions you're talking about
on the Russians.
On the Russians, of which the only ones I really saw were
you weren't satisfied with.
Evicting 35 Russian, the perfect 19th century solution to a 21st century problem. and closing two facilities that you're likely to have to give back at some point.
I take it you're not satisfied yet.
I would simply suggest that it wasn't fulsome.
So as we review this, I'll keep going.
Okay.
Because in addition to what we did and what the last administration did and what we continue to do, we sat down and in a very sober and pretty fast fashion, unfortunately, as I moved into that Warren that you described in the basement, decided that we had to put in place something that was actually doable, as opposed to those tools that are 20th century that you've articulated. If you only have a 20th century tool, you're going to use it. Well, we used it. It wasn't adequate in your mind. It wasn't adequate in my mind. What we need to do, living in the largest cyber glass house in the world, is figure out how to increase our defenses and put in place a rational strategy before we go out and do things that are going to make us and our private and critical infrastructure owners more vulnerable. So we'll satisfy you, but we just won't satisfy you in enough time, I think. Give me until August at very least, and I'll start to articulate some of the cyber policy. But if you will, and maybe you have another question, give me an opportunity, and I'll see if I can start to foreshadow for this group what a cyber strategy might look like under this administration.
Well, let's say that you're seeing continued activity from the Russians, the North Koreans, the Iranians of the kind you've seen. Yeah. If you had a Sony case today,
yeah,
a destructive hack,
right,
on a commercial activity, if you saw an attempt to get inside voter registration systems, even if it didn't, as you said, affect the vote count,
right,
what would you advise that we respond?
Okay, so the first thing you need to do is make sure that we don't have the David Sanger rule. And that is to be the one guy that decides what it is, I'm joking, what is or is not, what is or is not an acceptable behavior on the internet, right? And so by that I mean we need to have some agreed upon norms and standards and expectations. By the way, something President Trump then told in my recount of what we've done, President Putin pretty directly in their meeting. A lot has been said about their meeting and what he said and agreed to. But the first
thing.
Talking
about the first meeting.
not the dinner conversation.
Yes, right.
The point here is it's unacceptable, right? And the point is that point's been made clear and reiterated now by two very different presidents. And that's a little bit lost. But we can't then say this is something acceptable or not acceptable after we see it. And if I will, I'll be a little critical of the last team, but remember my caveat when I came in here, this is not a criticism based on malice. This is just an observation based on the perch that I sit in now. We had an opportunity to do something a little bit more strategic in the past, and given the time constraints and the tyranny of that time, we ended up with an ad hoc approach each time using the sensibilities of the president at the time to drive our actions. What I'd rather do in the future is figure out what together we consider acceptable behavior on the internet and unacceptable behavior, articulate that to the world so they know it, gain agreement inside our government that we're not going to violate that rule. The golden rule has to apply here or we lose credibility, and then move forward with punishing it when we find evidence of its abuse. That's a big step, and I want to stop by saying that that's a multilateral international obligation. We've had a lot of multilateral successes. There's a group of government experts at the UN that did a lot of work on that, and they came up with norms and rules. We need to agree upon them, and we need to codify that in some way that we all find acceptable as a nation. And then we have the terra firma that we need to go forward and say, you have violated that rule and it's time for you to be punished.
You have a unit at the State Department that was trying to negotiate that out. We hear it is either going to be reorganized or eliminated. It's not entirely clear and may not be clear until the full State Department reorganization is out there.
Yeah.
What's your ideal about what that would look like? Is that activity still centered in the State Department? Do you have a smaller, bigger, different kind of cyber unit within that?
So I'll work back. What I'd like to see is a vision, and then I'll come back to the tactical detail. What I'd like to see us pursue now is not a multilateral approach to deterrence. Once those rules are in place, I think history has taught us that that multilateral approach to action is a fool's errand. If we have a UN Security Council vote on what we're going to do to punish a bad cyber actor, it will likely be inevitably be held up with a vote and objection on whether you had enough proof, whether you've shown your evidence and revealed your classified programs or all the other things that we've seen in the past as non-starters in cyber attribution. What I'd like to start doing is pursuing with Secretary of State Tillerson's support and help and with others, Director Coates, I'd like to start seeing us pursuing a bilateral approach to punishment. And so I'd like to see us and another like-minded country get together on a particular case, agree that the evidence is sufficient, that the standard has been met, that the bad action and bad activity violated the standard I mentioned earlier of norms, and that we're going to pursue some action in it. And here's where we're playing jazz music. And by that, I mean we're improvising. There is no playbook for what is proportionate in cyber. And there is no playbook for satisfying the David Sanger rule. And so what we're going to have to do is find a way to experiment and see if it was in fact proportional, if it was in fact retractable enough to be suitable, and whether the rest of the international community of like-minded find it to have been pleasing.
And that penalty may not necessarily be in the cyber realm.
I hope it wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's no evidence to suggest that offensive cyber is a deterrent. Nobody's sitting around saying, boy, they might hack us, so let's not hack them. I've not seen anyone say that from an individual hacker to a nation state in my last 17 years looking at this problem. Instead, though, I'd like maybe some secondary sanctions. We could play with that. That's not just blocking somebody's bank account, but that's blocking their ability to do business in other banks in other countries that do dollar-denominated transactions. Those are pretty draconian, and we wouldn't want to do that without at least a partner with us. Anyway, that's an idea. I'm now a little bit out over my skis. We haven't figured out yet what we want to do in terms of punishment, but I'd like to move forward in a bilateral way, keeping the United States in a position of being able to enter into those agreements first with preconditions. And there's a lot of 20th century support for how we've done this before with SOFA agreements. There is some predicate for me to believe that this would work. And ultimately, remember, we will end up, hopefully, with a multilateral group of like-minded people that have all come together with us in a willing bilateral fashion. And so you've seen me. I flew to Israel and made this arrangement with the Israelis. We announced our first bilateral cyber arrangement between the United States and Israel. In this administration, we'll probably announce others. And one of the things I'd like to do is use that opportunity to negotiate with them some other things that are bedrock principles. We can talk about them with your future questions. But once those bedrock principles are met, we can then punish together. And then lastly, we're going to have to, the most important, figure out if there's a metric for success, whether it actually deters the bad action. And that's something you'll report on, and then I'll stop calling it the David Sanger rule.
Okay. One of the other cyber activities that we've seen in the past few months has been the spread of attacks like the WannaCry attack. Yeah. We saw first in Britain. I was just in Ukraine a week ago, and they got hit a few weeks ago with another variant that really made it impossible to do even basic credit card transactions and so forth. One of the concerns you read about this is that some of the vulnerabilities that these are based on appear to have leaked out from, let me find a delicate way to say this, U.S. taxpayer-supported activity that somehow leaked out of American systems.
Number three.
Yeah. The U.S. government has never acknowledged these, and I understand why you wouldn't, but you've got to be concerned about the perception around the world that the United States has exploited some vulnerabilities and then out of carelessness, bad luck, insider threats, Russian activity, who knows, whatever it is, these have gotten out into the wild and been used against us. So tell me how you're approaching this problem.
Yeah, so a couple things. This is an argument that I want to completely and directly...
You're listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum titled No Room for Error, Advising the President on Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. This is Aspen Public Radio. It is our summer pledge drive, and we can only bring you live broadcasts like this with your financial support. We have a goal of $500 for this hour during this broadcast. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
If we lost a missile and it was used elsewhere based on our technology, that there would be hell to pay for that.
That's to put a fine point on your question, that's what you're asking. So
yes.
I want to make sure I not only reject that analogy, but caution against the use of poorly or misapt analogies, because they lead to misunderstandings. And I'll stop there.
I'll take it you didn't like that one. Yeah. So take the analogy on. Tell us why it's wrong.
I want to, because what I'd like to do instead is say three-level setting things. First, it would be an abdication for us, the United States, or any nation, to stop developing exploits. And I see some others here that are probably nodding their head on this, that would allow us the means to develop intelligence to protect our country and our interests. Okay? That's a sacrosanct premise that I will stop with. Secondly, the weaponeering and the analogies are very, very different. A missile is a missile. It's a missile no matter how you use it and who uses it. A cyber vulnerability is not. There are a whole lot of players involved in taking some piece of code. And by the way, let me stop there and, go, and take a step back and digress. The United States or any other government or hacker, for that matter, doesn't develop the vulnerability, right? The software has the vulnerability, we find it. Now you've got that vulnerability identified in an exploitable way. The hacker develops an exploit. That's a hammer, it can be used in a lot of different ways, but if it's stolen and then turned into something that's used as a weapon or a tool because someone adds to it a delivery method, a long stick, a spike, and a nuclear weapon on the end of it, that hammer looks a lot different at the end. So the exploit can be used for good and for bad, and if the exploit is lost and used by a bad actor, it doesn't look like a missile anymore. And so there's a lot of problems with that weaponeering analogy, and I'll give you the second one.
So the liability is all on the hands of the person who's using it, using the vulnerability, and not necessarily, there's no liability in your mind on somebody who may have discovered a vulnerability, not reported it, and then lost track of it.
So the culpability, right, is the question. But you've also now got the software manufacturer that had a vulnerability. Now you've got the software manufacturer that developed and pushed a patch, which in this case they did.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got the user of the software that does or does not, in this case a lot did not, implement that patch. And then you've got third-party providers that for various reasons do or do not use those patches or update those software tools. So you've got 15 different players often involved in this. And the weaponeering is a little bit different too. Right now you'll have a major that knows how to use a rocket because it's going to go and make a bug splatter. And he's going to point it at a target within his area of operations, and he's going to follow the LOAC rules that we talked about, and it's going to make a certain explosion and kill the target. Terrorist tools are the same way, right? But cyber tools are different. Cyber tools are exploited in ways that can be profoundly misused. And what you saw from WannaCry was a wanton deployment, not a targeted one. And that ended up affecting, in a way that the hacker couldn't control, the entire world, right? We're lucky that that patch was out. I'm grateful to Microsoft that they not only made that patch free, but they pushed it out on their old unsupportable XP software platforms. That's something they had never done before. And they did that in a way that ended up saving lives because that hack spread around through hospitals and other things that could have caused the loss of life. And the hacker didn't have the ability to stop and say, wait a minute, this has gotten out of control. This has now affected China, Russia, Great Britain, and things that we're not going to collect ransom from. So if you want to say they took a missile and then turned it into a geothermal global nuclear weapons program, I think maybe your analogy would start getting a little closer, but you'd still have to insert 15 different weapons manufacturers, tool crafters, and parties that are involved in defending and creating offensive capability. So it's a little bit of a misnomer, but it's a big time attempt to try to accuse any company or any government of wrongdoing. I think that's the wrong thing to do. I would add a third point here now that I digressed. The third point here is, if we were to give this up, it would be tantamount to intentional disarmament, right? And this unilateral disarmament argument has been made. I want to reinforce it. There is no other government in the world that does what we do. We find vulnerabilities, talk about whether they have any real serious national security implication for us, and talk about whether those implications might be offset by the cause or the harm if they were misused. And then we decide to give away upwards of 90% of what we discover to the good guys so that they can patch against the use of those vulnerabilities against the bad guys. We are the only country in the world that does that. The 10% roughly that we keep for the use of our own national security and protection. And for us to now give up those other 10% because of a misunderstanding of the tool, I think would be foolish.
One more in the cyber realm that I just wanted to make sure that we covered. You have now inherited a plan from Congress to separate out Cyber Command from the NSA. It's mandated in the NDAA, but without the timing. We hear this moment may be coming. First, how soon is it going to be? And secondly, what are the risks, you think, of doing this? Can Cyber Command live on its own at this point? Does it have the capability? Could we end up replicating the capabilities we have in the NSA, which would be expensive?
So I'll deflect by saying I forgot one part of my last answer. And that is that a missile is used once and blows up. a cyber tool is used and is reused and is reused and is reused, and it exists in the internet forever. Cyber Command and NSA have two very different functions and purposes that are often misunderstood. But for right now, the NDAA requires a whole lot of conditions-based outcomes. So if we don't meet those conditions, we can't make that decision to separate. So Secretary Mattis will ultimately decide whether he wants to elevate Cyber Command to a 4-star combatant command and make that recommendation to the president. And then if he decides that he would like to separate those two, which is a resource question as much as it is a dual-headed management question for him, he's going to have to meet some internal operating capacity requirements that are conditions set in law, and that would take some time. So I would defer to Secretary Mattis. I'll certainly be involved in helping the president think through his recommendation, but I think that his recommendation on elevation and potential on separation would probably come this summer.
Mm-hmm. So relatively soon. There was one, of course, on President Obama's desk that he did not act on last summer.
Right.
So you think we're pretty close to having the conditions ready, sounds like.
I think that the decision could be made now. The conditions, if the decision were to separate, wouldn't be met for some period of time. And I wouldn't want to...
That could be a year or more, you think?
Whatever it takes. I wouldn't want to put them on a deadline that they couldn't meet.
Let's go to one other area before we go out to some questions. Biodefense, an area where you want to go make some changes. Tell us a little bit about it.
We left cyber too soon.
Okay.
But I'll let you
come back. We'll come back. You have things you want to say on cyber,
no.
Probably on 702 and the like.
I do. Suspect. I do.
702 is up for renewal. Are you going to get a clean renewal of it? Do you have something else in mind?
Let me do this for time so you can go to biodefense. I kind of view cyber and 702, and some of you might have seen a US-UK data sharing agreement that we're pursuing as an administration position as part of a theme of lawful access to information, which I think it's all related. So this theme of lawful access to information is how I think of the problem and how I'd like the president to think of it. If you don't have lawful access to information, you can't really talk about cybersecurity. In 702, there is absolutely no question, and I've put this out publicly, and this is our administration's position, that we need that tool and that those that misunderstand or intentionally conflate it with Title I FISA and things that are in the news and domestic intrigue is a damaging thing, and it's an unfortunate thing, depending on whether it's intentional. 702 is the part of FISA that allows us the authority to collect intelligence on a foreign person in a foreign land, period. It's not the part of the authority that allows us to collect intelligence on a foreign person in the United States or on a US person anywhere. This is a foreign person on foreign land, and it yields intelligence that saves lives, period, end of story. It's unassailable. We have two generations of administration officials that have all said this unanimously. So Congress rightly set a sunset clause when they put this new authority in place. It was a 10-year sunset clause. We thought that was a good opportunity for us to assess whether it worked. It's worked. We've had a court. We've had a PCLOB, this civil liberties oversight process, and we have had no abuses. Now, we've had internal problems that those mechanisms have identified and corrected, but the Fisk Court has come out at every time, at every juncture, even the last ruling, and reauthorized and reissued what we need to do, the certification process to continue the program. And even Charlie Savage on your team came out and wrote a very fair piece on that the last time the Fisk Court came out and said some critical things. So even the New York Times.
You're pretty generous to the failing New York Times.
Even the New York Times. The local New York rag got it absolutely right that we need 702 reauthorized and that the oversight functions that are there protect American people.
You'll go tell your boss you're impressed with our reporting.
I showed him that Savage article, and he was appreciative, and yeah. I was appreciative of him doing it. So on that, though, here's a little future thinking for your cocktail party tonight when you talk to me. Why do we need a 702 authority in 10 years' time? Why do we need that again? Why is it that a terrorist in a foreign land has any U.S. legal protection? Well, they don't. They don't need U.S. legal protection, but it just so happens that we make some really great tools, and so they like to use Gmail, and they like to use Twitter, and they like to use Apple devices because we have American innovation. In some cases, that data never traverses an American pipe, but nevertheless, we have an authority in place that says we need to gain permission from a U.S. court to pursue information from a foreign bad guy on a foreign land talking to another foreign bad guy. eventually we'll have a different view of the internet and we won't make it so parochial and so sovereignty-based. But for right now, we do. And for right now, we need that reauthorized. And for right now, I assure you that it's not being abused. And the one part of it that we couldn't control, that we weren't abusing intentionally, but we couldn't have the internal controls to look you in the eye and say 100% couldn't be abused or misused, we turned off. It's this theory of upstream collection. We turned it off, and I commend Admiral Rogers for recognizing that he just didn't have the back-end capability to keep those databases separate, and we turned
it off.
Will
you just go one more bit and explain to people what that upstream collection
is? It's what we call
a complex concept.
It's what we call upstream abats, and I'll make it really simple. If you have an email between David and Tom, and Tom's the target, and I'm a foreign bad guy in a foreign land, we can look at that under the authority. If you meet those preconditions. If Jane is doing research on Tom on the internet, that might be an upstream about activity, and that collection might end up...
You are listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum titled No Room for Error, Advising the President on Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. This is Aspen Public Radio. It is our summer pledge drive, and we can only bring you live broadcasts like this one with your financial support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org to help us meet our goal of $500 by the end of the hour. Thank you.
Wouldn't be able to, as an IG, look at that and say 100% you'll never have a violation despite your best intentions. I believe we'll get to a point where we can turn that back on, and the technical back-end capacity will be there. But for today, this is to and from collection of foreign bad guys doing foreign things in a foreign land that are bad, and they meet the definition that the court oversees. And I think we need that authority, and I think there'll be approval by the smartest and the most thoughtful bipartisan approval on the Hill. And I think there'll be a few that have some understandable privacy concerns, and they won't believe my assertion that we maintain controls. And then I think there'll probably be a few that intentionally conflate it with all the other domestic intrigue. But my hope is that we get it done. But my foreshadowing to you is that at some point in the future, we're going to have to relook at why we do it that way and why the pipes and where the data traverses matters to our legal system.
Let's run quickly to bio because we're running out of time, and I do want to get a few questions from the audience. You have in mind a new bio initiative. Tell us about it.
Yeah, maybe this is news. And for the wonky involved, you'll appreciate this. And this is something I should say has captured me since I was motivated into this field on 9/11. You'll recall the anthrax attacks that scared us soon thereafter. We have not had, as a country, a comprehensive biodefense strategy ever. We've had a lot of efforts. We've had a lot of good presidential directives under Presidents Bush and Obama, and we've had a lot of fits and starts in our investments. We've had some medical countermeasures and some debates on how to distribute them. But at this point, we need to look clear-eyed at the fact that we might have a devastating pandemic influenza or an intentional anthrax attack, or just to add to your concerns, if you weren't watching in the newspapers, there was a Canadian scientist that recently developed synthetic horsepox. That's not going to kill any of us, but that suggests that somebody might, in the future, now possess the capability to produce synthetic smallpox without the live virus. And that scares me to death. And it's high time that we have a biodefense strategy to address it, and this administration is going to create one. And we're going to do a comprehensive one led out of the White House, and we'll publish it as soon as we can. And we'll try to tie together all the various NDAA requirements that touch on all the various different departments, because we felt that was disjointed. I'm going to lead this as a coordinating matter for the president. But we then brought on a guy named Admiral Tim Ziemer, and for those of you that don't know him, he's the right guy. He's our senior director, and he should be all the evidence you need that this administration takes seriously not only biodefense, but the global health security agenda that President Obama promoted. And if I can, that is set to sunset in 2018, the global health security agenda. The United States has, at this point, put $1 billion into that effort, and I'd like to make sure you understand that this president supports it moving forward. Even as our budget requests go up and down and people write criticisms of us, we are still the leading contributor to that effort, and diseases travel without visas. So let's not have a conversation about our, you know, visa immigration issue on this. This is a problem that you can't fix by shutting down our borders or controlling our entry. Those controlling entry problems are different. This is a problem that is global, and the weakest country among us with the least preventative care problems or the least preventative care capabilities are going to be the patient zero outbreak source. And they're going to end up killing and infecting the world. And so we need to put money into places that don't have the money to do it themselves to prevent loss of life here. And so that's it. We will continue our full-throated support of the global health security agenda. We will hope to promote the other 10 countries and more, continuing it once it sunsets in 2018 and extending it. And then lastly, we will put together a comprehensive biodefense strategy for this country. And that's something I think the Hill knows, but I don't think the rest of the public knows. So you're the first to hear.
Great. So we have time for just a few questions. We'll start with Kim right here. There's a mic coming to you, Kim.
Hi, Kim Dozier with the Daily Beast and CNN. You've described... Is this on?
Yeah. Now it is.
Kim Dozier with the Daily Beast and CNN. You've described the ISIS strategy that you're creating as being related to what came before it. The Obama plan had 9 lines of effort. You so far have only described things like increasing the authority of people closer to the fight. Do you really need a new strategy? And when you roll it out, is it going to look a lot like the last one?
Okay, so 2 questions there. For those that didn't hear it, the question was, what are the differences between the last administration's defeat ISIS strategy and ours? And so I talked a lot about the differences between their strategy on counterterrorism in a global way. I think 2011 is the last time we published a national counterterrorism strategy, and that's something that we will update. And that's something that'll be a broader look towards the future in which we've taken the physical control of physical space away from the caliphate, so to speak, away from ISIS. So what we're looking to do here is not only predict the 2.0, but predict what we need to do over the long term to address the problem as it manifests from Germany to Libya to the Sahel in West Africa. The de-ISIS campaign is an ongoing military campaign. We've not put out anything on our effort there, comparatively or otherwise, and President Trump has been pretty clear about his lack of desire to forecast his punches on that. And so I think that we'll just let our outcomes speak. I will say one thing, a big thank you to the 68 members of the de-ISIS coalition, because a lot of them have ponied up more money, more troops, and more support in their last meeting and in this administration. And that's a really big deal for some of those countries. And so we couldn't do it without them. And I think it's all the evidence I could suggest here in this forum that we have a good plan, and the changes that we did make, whether they were big or small, satisfied those partners, every one of them.
And lady in the blue jacket right there.
Hi, Rachel Briggs with Hostage US. Thank you firstly for mentioning Bob Levinson, who's been held now for 10 years in Iran. I appreciate that. Could you comment on whether there have been any changes under this administration to the hostage policy, and whether you anticipate any changes or structural changes coming up in the near future?
Thank you for asking that question. Absolutely not. PPD 30, for those of you who don't know, is a good document. It came out of a lot of family contribution, so no government official deserves any credit for that. The families of the hostages, through frustration and experience, led to the development of that presidential policy. President Obama deserves some credit for signing it, and what came out of it and the key findings and the strategy that was published thereafter is all in place. We recognize every word of it, and we've continued. So I've picked up the responsibility that Lisa Monaco left for me. I've met with all the hostage families on a regular basis. It's a serious part of my job. And we're going to keep the structural improvements in place, from the hostage recovery fusion cell. That's an interagency operator body focused all the time, 100% of their time, on the recovery and return of hostages, dead or alive. But then also the interagency body at the White House that meets at this point, weekly basis, at very least biweekly basis, to talk about that at a policy level. So no changes. In fact, probably a redoubled effort. And we haven't had a policy meeting of any significance where we haven't talked about the implications to hostages since I've been there.
One last question, Bart in the back there.
Hi, Bart Gellman from Century Foundation and Washington Post. On 702 and the idea that it collects strictly on foreigners overseas, end of story, both PCLOB, which you mentioned, and the President's Review Board talked about the large amount of incidental collection and called for significant changes there. If you can't target Americans under 702, which you can't and you don't, but you pick up a lot of U.S. communications, incidentally, why should there not be a change that says you need a higher threshold to look at that, disseminate it, and use it?
I'm hearing we have very little time.
Yeah, I'm time hooked, Bart, so here's the short answer. That's a fancy new term to develop some mistrust or distrust of that capability and authority and how we use it.
But if you've ever seen an old movie, we've had Article III warrants issued against bad guys since the inception of our country. And if you decide to make a phone call to somebody that's being wiretapped, just to ask them to help take your trash out, you have been incidentally collected upon. There is no difference there. The authorities know the difference between collecting on the bad guy in the mob that they're listening to and the old lady next door who happened to call him and ask him to take their trash out for 200 years. And so there's no difference. There's an Article III comparison here, and that's the short answer. But there's some legitimacy to your question, and so I give it to you after we're done.
Well, thank you, Tom, for this. We covered a lot of territory. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a live broadcast from the 2017 Aspen Security Forum. You can also find this discussion in full later today on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. It is our summer pledge drive, and live broadcasts like this one from the Aspen Security Forum are only possible with support from you, our listeners. Lots of news outlets cover things like Ideas Festival, Aspen Music Festival, and school performances, and the Aspen Security Forum, which you just heard. But here on Aspen Public Radio, you can listen to sessions like this firsthand in their entirety and draw your own conclusions. We ask you to call in your pledge now so we can continue to bring you these types of live events, 920-9000, or go online to aspenpublicradio.org to pledge your support. Thank you. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. Your news, your music, your station.